Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, on episode 316, I have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Thomas Chula. Dr. Chula is a voluntary professor at Indiana University in the Department of Vitreoretinal Surgery. In addition, he is the CMO at Clearside, and he's going to join us, discuss a little bit of his career, and really focus on what we see as the next developments in retina, transitioning from a career in retina into a career in industry. And we talk a little bit about what we see happening in the next 5 to 10 years, especially as it applies to suprachoroidal drug delivery. As always, a list of financial disclosures can be found in the episode description. There is also a link to claim CME credits for this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes. That link will take you to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website to claim CME credits there, typically a half credit per 30-minute episode. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is honored to be joined by Dr. Thomas Chula. Dr. Chula is the Clinical Medical Officer and Chief Development Officer at Clearside Bio. In addition, he is a voluntary clinical professor at Indiana University. And Dr. Chula is joining us today. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me, Jay, and thanks for your interest.
So we usually start podcasts by getting a sense of where people came from and what got them to where they are today. So tell us a little bit about your career, how you ended up being an ophthalmologist and a retina specialist.
Great question. I have to, when I'm asked these sort of questions, I have to stop and think back how far we've come as a field. So I trained and went to Harvard College and then to UCSF Med School and ended up doing my residency at Mass Eye and Ear. And back in those days, everything was different. You know, we didn't have anti-VEGF therapies. We didn't even have OCT. All the surgical instrumentation was 20 gauge. We didn't have wide angle viewing systems. We didn't have, all the illumination equipment we have for surgery. So really everything was different therapeutically, diagnostically, and surgically. And I have to look back and think that we as retina specialists at this time are so fortunate to have witnessed so much innovation in our field, really in a short period of time, over a couple of decades. And I think anti-VEGF has changed so many people's lives in the country. And we're on the precipice of a whole new wave of innovation with gene therapies. I was at Spark before Clearside. And I marvel at the fact that the very first approved gene therapy for inherited disease in the United States was in our field in retina. So we're on this precipice of an entire new wave of innovation. So I think retina specialists have had a great run. We've been involved in so much innovation. And I've had a bit of a front row seat to that because when I trained at Mass Eye and Ear, I trained with some of the folks who were very much involved in the development of the early anti-VEGF agents. Folks like Joan Miller and Tony Adamus, Evan Grigutis, Lloyd Pollaiello. I'm always, when I think back, I almost get goosebumps thinking about how far we've come and how much more we have to do.
In terms of your career, you've had a lot of different hats and roles. Tell us a little bit about those transitions, right? You've worked in the private side, you've had academic positions and now industry positions. Any kind of feedback for younger retina specialists about the different sort of pros and cons to each one and what you've encountered in a very diverse career?
Yeah, sure. So when I finished my training in Boston, I got married young. We had two children and started looking around at positions. And I realized, this is back in 1996, that Boston proper had like 60 retina specialists, half of whom were world famous. And back then, we didn't have all the anti-VEGFs with all the need for the injections. So I realized that it'd probably be better for me career-wise to start somewhere else. So I ended up, and I think what I'm getting at is I think younger retina specialists, just as I did, you need to go where there's unmet need. And I think that's true geographically and also in terms of career interests. So I looked around and ended up interviewing at Indiana University. And I don't think I ever even had been to Indiana, but I realized that it was just an incredible opportunity at this time because it was the only medical school in the state. It's the biggest medical school in the country at 11 campuses. And at the time, it was a traditional academic job. So they gave me a lab with startup funds and got to work on anti-angiogenesis models with different anti-angiogenic agents. But I think the theme back then is still relevant, and that is go where you're needed and also do what's needed. So I remember one of my mentors told me that I should do what nobody else wants to do. So back then, nobody wanted to do AMD. We only had laser back then. So that got me interested in angiogenesis, but also back then nobody wanted to do CMV retinitis. And I think my colleague and I, Ron Danis, were probably among the busiest retina specialists in the United States implanting GAN cyclophere implants at that time. And so I ended up doing some uveitis and infectious disease and a lot of angiogenesis. And it really worked out well for me. And I would encourage any young retina specialist to think about maybe not pursuing what's already been well developed, but going where there is unmet need currently.
Yeah, that's a great point. And so unmet needs evolve. And obviously, if any of us had a crystal ball, we would be millionaires, billionaires, because we could predict the unmet needs well in advance. But, you know, it seems right now the big unmet need that everyone's trying to address, you referenced, is durability of therapy and treatment for dry AMD. I think those are kind of the two holy grails, durability of something more durable in anti-VEGF and treatment for dry AMD. I think that durability for dry AMD is not anyone's worrying about right now because, you know, we don't even have a treatment. But I wonder, do you think that's going to be if you fast forward 10 years, that's going to be the next hot topic, assuming we make the connections we need to, or is there something I'm not thinking of that will take precedence even over that?
Always hard, you know, to predict the future, right? My crystal ball is cracked, but yeah, I agree. I think geographic atrophy is a huge area of unmet need. There are no therapies. We have an aging of the population, many of whom will be afflicted with this. And we also live in a more visually dependent society. You know, senior citizens all have smartphones and iPads and read a lot. So I think geographic atrophy represents just an enormous unmet need. So I think that will be really important. I think delivery of healthcare will be really important. So I ended up getting an MBA specializing in the business of medicine, and ended up getting a green belt in Lean Six Sigma. I looked at practice efficiency in my own office and published some papers on this, but I think delivery of healthcare is really important. How do we provide the very best care to an increasing population that needs care and do it most efficiently so that we're conserving resources? And I think that's a huge unmet need. So I think there'll be, there's an opportunity for retina specialists and physicians throughout the system to work on ways to make the system more efficient. And whether that's through Lean Six Sigma or telemedicine or artificial intelligence, I think that's where the big unmet need is healthcare delivery. And obviously it goes beyond retina. And I'm also very proud of the fact that ophthalmology, in particular retina, has often led waves of innovation in healthcare. And I think again, retina can lead a wave of innovation in telemedicine, artificial intelligence interpretation of diagnostic testing, also being able to, explore perhaps how we can use other healthcare providers, maybe not retina specialists, but other healthcare providers to work in the system to deliver care, to the right patient at the right time more efficiently. So I think those are some of the unmet needs that at least I predict can be addressed in the near future by, smart, ambitious, young retina specialists.
Yeah, those are great points. And that's, again, a huge topic right now is AI deep learning. The other thing you always think about in fields is, and there's been a lot of conversation, I think maybe not nationally on a big stage by retina specialists, but I hear a lot of friends talking about it. I think it's doubtful that we'll ever be quote unquote obsolete. But as you've sort of referenced, our role may change. We've seen that in other fields of medicine with anesthesiology and physician extenders. Radiology has changed completely from where it was 20 or 25 years ago with teleradiology, Nighthawk, and other things that have come across, come out in the field. Retina may be going through that transformation. You know, we traditionally had surgical retina folks. There was a real boom of medical retina trained professionals, you know, maybe 5-10 years ago, and that sort of has died down as people realize they do want surgical retina folks, especially as some of these therapies we're going to talk about, you know, gene therapy, suprachoroidal treatment, maybe better delivered by a retina trained person. But I wonder if a lot of the things that we do on a daily basis today, and you reference this, injections, but even just reading imaging, OCTs, fundus photos, FAs, you know, OCTA as that technology develops. I mean, how much of that do you think will be automated or sort of done maybe remotely? And that will sort of change, if you were mentoring young retina folks, what they need to be, you know, doing in terms of preparing to have a long career.
Yeah, I know. I your point's well taken. And, you know, in terms of mentoring younger retina specialists, I think, you know, we can predict where the hot topics will be, the hot areas will be, but really it's a dedication to lifelong learning and intellectual curiosity. I think that's what drives success in this field. And I feel like we're all so blessed to have colleagues that are just so incredibly intelligent, driven, intellectually curious, you know, read broadly. A lot of retina specialists seem to be interested in not only retina, but often in other disciplines. They might be interested in you know, software development or imaging, drug development, you know, aspects of business. And then with that broad knowledge base, they can then adopt areas from other fields into retina and then allow some of the changes that you and I just alluded to. You know, maybe we won't be doing injections as much anymore. Maybe we'll be, you know, supervising AI systems or other healthcare providers or, you know, managing healthcare systems. But I think it will evolve. And I think the important piece for younger retina specialists to think about is just to continue to read broadly, learn as much as they can. And often, you know, if they have other interests, try to bring them into the field of retina. I think that cross-pollination really drives innovation.
Great points. Let's talk a little bit, you know, you referenced kind of the different hats and roles that you've worn. Let's focus specifically on an industry for a second. You know, I think it seems like there's many paths to get there. There's some people who join industry even post-medical school after a year or two. There's people listening to this podcast who may be finishing fellowship, and we've known people who've gone straight from fellowship into an industry job. It seems for the most part, most retina specialists who go into industry have worked for some period of time. And at some point decided, okay, I want to make this transition. Can you talk a little more about like your day-to-day, how it changes, how it differs, the trade-offs, you know, because I've had a couple friends I've chatted with, they've talked about, you know, it's a little more, you know, there's travel components, there's meeting components. It depends a little bit if you're on the development side or medical affairs side. Any comments or thoughts?
Sure. Yeah, lots of comments. So I mentioned I was at Indiana University, had an angiogenesis lab, a traditional, you know, academic existence. I had, you know, different clinics that taught residents, staff the Veterans Hospital, the county hospital. It was great experience. It was great just to immerse myself into all things retina at the time. And I think that really, you know, builds the foundation, that experiential foundation, which I think is important in industry. And then right around early 2000s, there was this boom in clinical trials and clinical research. So then I got more and more involved in that. And I joined an academically oriented big private practice, did lots of clinical trials. I ended up, you know, after a while, you end up being invited to sit on data safety monitoring committees. I was a medical monitor for a trial. And so on and so forth. So also more building of this experience base. And then fast forward, after about 20 years, I found myself just doing lots of injections. And I think that's great work. You're helping a lot of patients. It can be very lucrative if it's done well. But I got to the point where I just felt myself stagnating and decided, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and decided to get this MBA specializing in healthcare. And I think that was really transformative for me, because I was in this cohort of only physicians. There are 35 other physicians. I was the only ophthalmologist. And I realized what I really liked doing was to think very systematically about retina. So, how do you, where are the unmet needs? Is there an asset that could potentially be a therapy? How would you assess that therapy in the clinical trials? What should the endpoints be? Should it work? Is it a sustainable therapy? Does it meet unmet needs? How would you commercialize it? I really like thinking about all that. But I think I couldn't have gotten there had I not had all this experience in academia and with the lab and, with clinical trials and teaching residents. So for me, that was the right path. It may not be the right path for everybody. And then that just naturally evolved into working part-time at Iveric, which was then Ophthotech. And I really feel very grateful to Samir Patel and Dave Geyer for giving me a chance, first part-time and then full-time. I actually got to help design the GATHER1 trial, which is, now obviously in the news because it was a successful phase 3 trial with Zimura. GATHER2 is underway. Then the opportunity came along at Spark Therapeutics, and I jumped at that opportunity. It was a once in a lifetime opportunity to be involved with the first gene therapy for genetic disease in the U.S. And, I mentioned earlier about healthcare delivery. What I learned at Spark was that, the gene therapy was very innovative, but there was a lot of other innovation in the system. For example, we created this pay for performance model where Spark would essentially rebate insurance companies if patients didn't meet certain criteria of visual improvement. We had to introduce to the retina community this multi-luminance mobility test, which is a novel endpoint. Nobody really understood what it was at the time, except for those who worked in it, because we're all so fixated on visual acuity. We had to introduce the concept of ocular gene therapy treatment centers. So I remember flying in surgical retina specialists from around the country where we trained them with the animals, where we had vitrectomy units all set up. Train them on subretinal surgery. So we set up the Center of Excellence model. But anyway, these were all innovative. And to my earlier point, I think there's a real role for retina specialists to think about innovation, not just traditionally with sort of hard science, but also with healthcare delivery, setting up ocular gene therapy treatment centers or pay for performance models. These are all really important areas that need to develop further. Not just in gene therapy, but throughout healthcare. So so the transition, you asked about the transition. It occurred very gradually. It's been a really fun ride. And then more recently, 3 years ago, I joined Clearside. And 2 weeks after I got to Clearside, we announced a phase 3 trial. It didn't meet its endpoint. The stock crashed. The chief scientific officer left. The CEO left. We had to shut down all these global clinical trial sites. So lots of the clinical operations team left and half the medical affairs team left. And so I was like, wow, what did I do? I just left Spark Therapeutics. It was a really fun company. It was, I was learning a lot. And I was like, I was sort of surprised that maybe I made the wrong choice. But I realized that part of being a leader is trying to make your environment the best it can be, wherever you are. And so I helped rebuild the company. Our stock is up. I helped bring in some therapeutic assets, which are now in a phase 1-2 trial. We brought in some clinical assets. We've had to refile our NDA for our first asset, but Xipere, and we have a PDUFA date of late this month. So hopefully that'll be approved. But again, I think retina specialists can play a role in healthcare delivery and in the industry and, serving as leaders because they understand, kind of the patient journey and are able to connect all the dots. So think systematically, like I mentioned earlier, where, you could connect the dots between unmet patient needs, the science behind a potential therapeutic asset. Again, how would you study it in a clinical trial, what the endpoints would be, and so on and so forth. So for me, the transition was very gradual, and you know, every experience is built on the prior experiences. But that's not to say that somebody out of fellowship could go right into industry. It's certainly possible. You know, there are some advantages of that potentially, where you know, someone very bright could be mentored in an industry role, and you know, they have a much longer runway in industry than I do, and really could advance very, very high up in industry, and have really profound influences not only in our field but throughout the healthcare system. So I think there's lots of paths, as you mentioned. You know, this is the path I've taken. It's worked for me. It's really, I really feel like I've had a lot of fun having a front row seat to, you know, lab research, clinical research, and now working in industry. But you know, there are different paths possible, and it's just, you know, you can leave it to one's own imagination what might be possible going forward for young, bright retina specialists.
Let's end by talking a little bit about suprachoroidal delivery. Obviously, your company has worked extensively in that space, but just in general, let's talk about it as a delivery method, right? So it's interesting to think about the history of these things. Intravitreal therapy, dating back to delivering intravitreal antibiotics and steroids and anti-VEGF, was always sort of the preferred method. The historical origins of suprachoroidal delivery, right? At what point did it become something where people said, well, you know, we can actually access this space and achieve good efficacy? And then future applications, right? Steroids from your company, but also gene therapy. And, you know, I guess the possibilities are limitless if you can access this space, maybe with a reduced side effects profile.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's an interesting question. So actually, this drugging a potential space is not a new concept. So the anesthesiologists do this all the time with epidural anesthetics. They will, in labor delivery, they'll drug that potential space. So it's not a new concept, but it is much newer, obviously, in the eye. And it was sort of discovered by accident by Hank Edelhauser in Georgia in his lab. And he was pleasantly surprised when one of his postdocs was unable to inject into the sclera. They were actually working on injecting into the sclera at the time as sort of a sustained release. And the story goes, the postdoc came to him and said he couldn't find the drug. And ultimately they realized it had gone into the suprachoroidal space. And I think he was the first person to come up with the idea of drugging this potential space. And then, you know, since then, some of the intellectual property has been spun out of Georgia Tech and Emory to form ClearSide. And the first proof of concept asset was a steroid, because, you know, it's an obvious question. We all know steroids work, but can you compartmentalize them away from the front of the eye to minimize the risk of glaucoma or cataract? And that's how that asset evolved. And it's been a long road. There are lots of challenges with developing an injector that's reliable, and then to formulate triamcinolone in a way that can be injected repeatedly through this 30 gauge system. And also the system involves a loss of resistance technique. So you have to be able to feel for loss of resistance as you're injecting, so that even the formulation needs to be optimized for that. But suffice it to say, you know, we showed efficacy and safety in a phase 3 trial. I mentioned earlier, we filed the NDA. We have a PDUFA date of October 30th. So hopefully it'll be approved then. And it's an important approval because it'll represent, you know, the first approved suprachoroidal therapy. And it'll also validate the platform more. But since then, you know, there's other ideas for drugging this potential space. It turns out that small molecule suspensions work really well in this space, because what drives durability is the relative insolubility of a therapy as well as the particle size. So we've looked at not only triamcinolone, but a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, axitinib in particular. We've looked at a complement inhibitor and a plasma kallikrein inhibitor, and we've presented these at different meetings. But in all of these cases, they're insoluble small molecule suspensions. when we inject in the suprachoroidal space, the injectate flows circumferentially and posteriorly. The vehicles ultimately absorb, and it leaves behind these insoluble drug particles that basically sit in the space, which acts like a drug reservoir, and the drug slowly leaches out into the adjacent choroidal tissues to really target them. And you can have up to many months of durability. So hence, we're looking at a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, axitinib, now, which is in a phase 1-2 trial. And then there's a lot of interest in gene therapy, because we all know that when you inject intravitreally, the internal limiting membrane can function as a barrier, although there are some vectors that get through that barrier. But in the case of AAV8, which REGENXBIO uses, they found that they can actually get fairly good results preclinically. And of course, that's in the phase 2 trial now, their RGX314 gene therapy, which produces a Lucentis-like protein. It's in a phase 2 trial for both diabetic retinopathy and wet AMD. And then finally, another company, Aura Biosciences, which is a private company in Cambridge right now, is looking at virus-like drug conjugates injected into suprachoroidal space for a treatment of choroidal melanoma. And, you know, I think this intuitively makes a lot of sense. The choroidal melanoma originates in this tissue, essentially. It's a number one primary intraocular malignancy in adults. And you can target very high levels of this virus-like drug conjugate to the affected layer. This virus-like drug conjugate delivers a dye very specifically to the melanoma, and it's activated with a non-thermal laser light. And their rabbit models really show, breathtaking results where the tumor essentially melts. And that's currently in trial as well. And it's really interesting. This year, we've had numerous presentations, just actually last week at American Society of Retina Specialists, looking at some of these trial results. So it's really exciting. Right now, there's three different assets being assessed in four different trials using suprachoroidal delivery. So we may be on the precipice of an entirely new way to deliver drugs to the eye. And, you know, it's the result of you know, years of work with multiple teams, but it's very exciting. So I think drug delivery, and as you said initially, durable drug delivery is going to become a really important theme for our field.
Yeah, this is really great. It's a good overview of where we are right now. The choroidal melanoma stuff especially is super, super interesting. And like you said, potential spaces have existed and people thought about accessing them, but now we finally may have the technology to do them. And then, and you sort of touched on this, but I'm curious, how do you quantify? So one of the issues that people have discussed with all these therapies is some sort of systemic exposure, right? You know, the suprachoroidal space in theory is not directly involving the choroid, but are there any sort of concerns or anything that's come up in terms of considering whether there'd be greater systemic exposure to drug? I know in anti-VEGF for years, people have talked about systemic levels between agents and whether it differs and whether that's clinically significant and maybe more clinically significant in certain scenarios, such as pregnancy or prematurity, babies receiving anti-VEGF injections. How about in terms of suprachoroidal space? Like, is that increased, decreased? Does anyone know what that is relative to intravitreal drug delivery?
That's a great question. So what drives durability, as I mentioned earlier, is relative insolubility. It's for small molecule suspensions, relative insolubility of a drug, as well as the particle size. It turns out that the choriocapillaris pore size is between 6 and 12 nanometers. And so when we inject these suspensions, these drug particles are on the order of microns. So they're really huge compared to the choriocapillaris pore size. So by and large, they don't go into the choriocapillaris, at least not initially. And then, as I mentioned, the drugs will slowly dissolve into the adjacent tissues over time. And so at least in small molecule suspensions, the levels, even in the aqueous, are low to undetectable, and in systemic circulation are generally very low to undetectable. We reported some of this for our Azalea study in the British Journal of Ophthalmology last year with our first asset site here, we're trying some lacetinide. And the levels are very low systemically. So we think it'll be as low, maybe lower than intravitreal. I mean, this is a new field, so we're still learning. And then going back to particle size again, in the choriocapillaris pore size. Same thing with gene therapy. So these AAV vectors, AAV2, for example, is on the order of about 25 nanometers. And as I mentioned, the choriocapillaris pore size is less than half of that. So these gene therapies won't be swept into the choriocapillaris very rapidly. And hence, there should be little exposure to the systemic circulation. So that's just a basic overview of how the concepts behind suprachoroidal drug delivery. And I should add that, I'm always asked, well, what about just injecting, Eylea or Lucentis or Avastin suprachoroidally? Well, it turns out that these are biologics in solution. So if you inject them in solution, you will get super high levels to the affected tissues, but because they're in solution, they'll be immediately swept out into the, we think into the choriocapillaris and also through the uveoscleral outflow pathways. But again, just to answer your question, small molecule suspensions, gene therapies, nanoparticles, generally don't go through the choriocapillaris.
Great. No, Dr. Chula, I really appreciate you taking the time. I learned a lot listening to you, and hopefully our listeners learned a lot as well. And again, look forward to seeing you. You're a frequent speaker at OIS, as you were at ASRS recently, and then OIS has multiple events, a podcast, and meetings throughout the year, and also speaking on behalf of your company at Clearside. So thank you again for, all the mentorship you've done over the years and for sharing some insights.
Jay, thank you so much for having me. And I just want to say, I think the future is super bright for our field. And, I feel so fortunate to be working with so many bright, young, curious retina specialists with lots of energy like you and many of your colleagues. So again, thank you for your interest.
Have a great day, Dr. Chula. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all our other episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's retinapodcast.com. All 316 episodes, including this one, are found there, sorted by category and easily searchable. We have a link there on the website where you can subscribe and get email updates on the latest episodes. You can also subscribe in the Apple Podcast app or in your Android Podcast app on your mobile device. Find us on social media on Facebook and Twitter at Retina Podcast. And remember, we love feedback. We love getting reviews in the App Store for those of you who leave reviews there. We love emails about episode ideas, what you'd like to see done in the future, what you'd like to see continue. So please always feel free to reach out. Many thanks to Dr. Chula for joining us for this episode. Thank you to Drs. Angela Chang, Mike Benincasa, and Louis Kai for all they do for the podcast behind the scenes. Thank you, listeners, for all the work you do, the patients you take care of, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.